There are two reasons why I almost never give political talks from the pulpit. One is that I have no special expertise. Many of you follow politics at least as closely as I do. So why does the fact that I get to stand up here mean that I should inflict my views about politics on you when you know as much as I do, or in many cases more, about the same issue? The second reason is that I've discovered, after many, many years of arguing about many, many things, that the best definition of argument is the process of convincing yourself that you were more right than you thought you were at the beginning of the argument. And it almost never happens that at the end of a heated argument, someone goes, you know, now that we've discussed this, I really think you may be right. So why? And therefore, I generally just leave it alone. But having come back from the AIPAC conference and having been asked by so many people what my impressions are, I'm going to offer you my impressions, but before I do, I want to make clear that these are my impressions. This is not the Torah from Sinai. This is not what everybody at Sinai Temple must believe. You are free to disagree with everything I say. I have good friends and people I respect, some of whom I will mention along the way, who would bitterly disagree with what I'm going to say. So take it as you will, but I don't want to have brought along with myself, the Cantor, the President, Jan Zakowski, hundreds of people to AIPAC, and then come back and just say to you it was a nice conference. There were 10,000 people there, a lot happened, and I want to divide up my impressions into my impressions of the President, the Prime Minister, and the event itself. And I want to start with President Obama. There is a lot of what I consider loose talk about the president being anti-Israel. It's my impression that even though people may feel this for reasons that I will come to in a minute, there's no way that that can be sustained by the facts. First of all, military aid to Israel is greater than at any time in U.S. history. If you ask military people in Israel, military cooperation with the United States is more intimate and better coordinated than at any time in Israel's history. The president was the first person to say a demilitarized Palestinian state. No other president has said that. Not only that, he said at his AIPAC speech that Hamas was a terrorist organization and you could not negotiate with someone bent on your destruction. He's clearly trying to head off the UN declaration, which is part of his motivation in going to Europe, although I suspect unsuccessfully. He clearly said when he was there that that Israel must always be a Jewish state, which effectively rules out the Palestinian right of full return. And he has surrounded himself by people, Dennis Ross, Rahm Emanuel, Hillary Clinton, who are not only passionate supporters of Israel with long records of support of Israel, but I don't think would work for any president that they really believe was anti-Israel. Now, I know that there are people, as I said, whose opinions I respect and whom I read, Bret Stephens, Charles Krauthammer, John Podhoretz, and others, who think that I'm wrong. Okay. Fair enough. You may think so, too. Entirely up to you. But I really think if you look at the facts, there's almost no way to sustain the charge that he is anti-Israel, and especially, by the way, when he says the 67 borders with mutually agreed swaps, which is the exact same formula, word for word, the 1967 borders with mutually agreed swaps that the State Department and the Israel Foreign Ministry issued together in a joint communique 2 years ago, the Israel Foreign Ministry. So when you use that formula, which has been, by the way, the basis, whether spoken or not, of every negotiation from Clinton in 2000 to Olmert in 2008, when you use that formula, that doesn't, by use of the formula, make you anti-Israel unless the Israel Foreign Ministry is anti-Israel. Having said that, why do people think that the president is anti-Israel, as many do? Because I think there is no question. Oh, I wanted to make one other point before I get to why. The one other point was, do you know which president first said a two-state solution and said that there must be a Palestinian state? President George W. Bush. And I mention that only because, can you imagine if President Obama had been the first one to say that? The Jewish community would have gone ballistic. But because it was President Bush, we didn't. And why didn't we? This is why, and this goes back to the question of why people believe that the president is anti-Israel. With President Reagan, with President Clinton, with President Bush the second, I'll leave the first aside for a moment. You felt their love. They loved Israel. They felt deeply in their bones the remarkable, miraculous promise that it held. They did. It came off of them in waves of warmth, all of them, in different ways. Not with this president. At least, I don't feel it. If you say to me, is President Obama anti-Israel, I'll say absolutely not. I believe he's pro-Israel. If you say, is he a lover of Israel, then I stop. That I don't feel. And I think that because we are, our antenna as a Jewish community are so sensitive, as they should be, when we see someone who's the head of government that doesn't really line up with us, not only in terms of policy, but completely emotionally, when we see a president who is the first one who believes that he's capable of making a visceral appeal, a gut appeal, to the Palestinians and to the Arab world, we get very nervous. And I think that that was a big part of what happened over the past several days, in addition to the fact that the president was spectacularly maladroit. In other words, he did this very badly. Very badly. You don't choose the moment before the Israeli prime minister is coming to stir up a controversy. It's bad timing. Not only that, but he paid a huge political price. Because in the end, we all know who came out looking better in the eyes of the American voters who cared and of Israel. So if you ask me, did he do this well? Does he convey a love of Israel? My answer is, personally speaking, I don't feel it. But is he a supporter of Israel? Do I trust him not to throw Israel under the bus, as one irresponsible comment put it? Yes, I do. Now, you may take that any way you want, but I'm going to give you a similarly mixed verdict on Prime Minister Netanyahu. So Prime Minister Netanyahu came to the United States, and the president made this statement, and he had several choices. One choice, the choice he took, was to say, we will not go back to 67 borders, neglecting the fact that no one had said, we're going back to 67 borders. But it was a great applause line. Right? Nobody said we were, but he insisted we weren't. And we said, you're right, we're not. God bless you. Also, my other criticism is that Israel should be, every single day of the week, putting a new plan on the table. When he came before the joint session of Congress, can you imagine what it would have been if he had said, you know, I know we're all arguing about maps. I want you to know I brought five different maps of possible settlements because the Israeli government is constantly generating ideas. Now let's see how the Palestinians respond to this. And of course, there would have been no response. But instead, the government is stagnated in the, we can't negotiate with them because of Hamas, which is true, and therefore we will generate no ideas. And I think to myself, where is the diplomatic creativity that says to the world, we're generating ideas, but nobody's saying anything? I was disappointed that there wasn't more coming from the Israeli government that would illustrate the reality that we all know, which is one side really is prepared for peace and the other side isn't. Having said that, and having expressed my disappointment in what I was disappointed at, he was masterful. A lot of politics, as you know, is how you appear and how you sound. And boy, his speech at AIPAC was good, but he was clearly saving it for the joint session. And it was an extraordinary oratorical performance. And there was no way, I don't care what your views, I don't care if you're a Netanyahu fan or you're not a Netanyahu fan, there was no way to listen to that presentation of the history and dilemma and situation of Israel and not feel a swelling of pride at the fact that that was the spokesman, really, in a genuine sense, of the Jewish people at that moment before the non-Jewish world. And so in that sense, in the sense that I'm disappointed that there wasn't more creativity, and I wish that the focus had been other, but it was a powerful and proud moment, and I was not at all surprised, not at all surprised, when even the people who were detractors of Netanyahu were sort of dragged into saying his appearance before the joint session of Congress was an extraordinary moment. As one commentator remarked, he was sure that there were some congressmen who wished he were running for president, because he could have, I mean, he certainly could have been elected if all you needed was a parliamentary majority. And that was great. And that was great. And it illustrated what I want to say that is really the overarching lesson here, which is bigger than Obama and bigger than Netanyahu. Because the truth is, my real impression is, in a year, we'll probably be right where we are now. I wish that were not the case, but I suspect it is. And we all know, and the reason why I said this diplomatic creativity is so important, is that in the end, time is not on Israel's side. I wish it were, but it is not. The day is gone when you could make a deal with three autocrats and you would be okay. As the Arab world increases in ferment, Israel's security does not increase. As the demographics weigh more and more against us, Israel's security does not increase. As Iran gets closer and closer to a nuclear bomb, Israel's security does not increase. And so the stagnation is frightening because the world gets more and more frightening. And because nobody has a good solution to an impossible problem. And yet, anybody who attended the AIPAC conference, who has any sense of the arc of history, has to be amazed by the following two phenomena. First of all, you stood there in the convention center, where for the first time, by the way, they had to have two dinners because the convention center in the nation's capital was not large enough to hold the 10,000 people who showed up. So you had a separate dinner of 1,500 young people who showed up. And you realized that this was a different America It was a different America from the America that my parents grew up in, where during World War II, American leaders were afraid to speak out, where they didn't put nearly as much pressure on the government as they might have, where they didn't feel they had the influence and they thought there might be a backlash. Instead, what happened was, as I walked from my hotel to the convention center, there were this straggly group of protesters. They show up every year. I kind of like them. They're sort of endearing because there's 20, 30 people of various backgrounds holding signs saying really despicable things. And the great thing is thousands of Jews walk by them and ignore them. In fact, as I was walking back to my hotel, one of them went out onto the street and a policeman yelled at them and said, "I told you on the grass, this is your last chance." And you realize that America is different than it was. It's not the same. And the reason it's different is because there's an Israel. The increase in the self-confidence of American Jews is attributable to the existence of Israel. And that is an extraordinary and powerful gift. But it's not the only reason. Because when I stood there and watched the address to the joint session of Congress, and, you know, every 2 seconds, everybody stood up and applauded. Hundreds of whom, by the way, had been at the AIPAC dinner the night before, because the majority of senators and the majority of the House attended that dinner. I thought to myself, why is it that the congressman from East Nowhere, just south of like Six Pack, Midwest, who doesn't have a Jew in his constituency, who wouldn't know a Jew if he fell over a kosher butcher store, why is he standing and applauding every time the Prime Minister of Israel raises his pitch a little? Why is that happening? And the answer is that it is not true. It's a demonstrable, clear falsehood that the Jewish lobby somehow influences the government to support Israel, and in fact, without them, they wouldn't. Because this congressman doesn't have Jews in his district, doesn't get Jewish money. But he or she loves Israel. And the reality is that America, as a country, as a nation, as a population, really does care for the state of Israel, which is why again and again and again you saw all these people in Congress, including, by the way, people that you know oppose some of Netanyahu's views. Not all of them see the territories or the settlements the way he does. But they still have a powerful emotional connection to the land that gave birth to the three monotheistic faiths. They do. And so they stand and they applaud in spite of the fact that they have policy differences. And that not everything that he says is what they would say in his place. In fact, I think it is fair to say that America as a whole is supportive of Israel, with the single exception of these isolated islands that we call college campuses. Apart from a certain string of college campuses, and we can all name them, this country and Israel are tied together in a way that I can illustrate with a story about what Menachem Begin once said to Ronald Reagan in a cabinet meeting. When they met, the president said to the prime minister, "Call me Ron." And Prime Minister Begin said, "No, I can't do that. You call me Menachem, but I can't call you Ron. You're the president of the United States." And he said, no, I insist." So they went to the cabinet meeting. They were Ron and Menachem. And Reagan said something about Israel being a key strategic asset And Begin said, Ron, I don't want to be a strategic asset. I want to be a strategic ally. This was after they had knocked out the Osirik reactor. He said, I want to be a strategic ally. What Americans realize is that even though the world may see it this way, it's not a paternalistic relationship. Israel is not a client state. Israel is a fiercely independent state where not a single American soldier has ever given his or her life in order to defend the land, because Israel defends itself. Israel's a state with tremendous cooperation, not only on military matters and intelligence matters, only the surface of which any of us know, but also in high tech, in companies, in industry, in brain power, in university professors, and I dare say, even though I can't prove it, in computer programs that help sabotage Iranian nuclear reactors. That's what the congressmen were reacting to. They understand that it's not so simple. And they know that even if there is this, what I would say is a momentary fight over what the president said and how to interpret it and how the prime minister reacts, that the deeper currents of closeness are not breached. And that it is not too much to say that at the highest levels of government, Israel and America love one another, understand one another, and share the fundamental values on which they were both built, which is, we will be a refuge for disparate people from all over the world, and we know that as we gather them together, there will be a creative, dynamic energy because of that very gathering that will exceed anything else the world has ever seen. That's what I really took back from AIPAC. What I really took back was this idea that in the heart of the nation's capital, we weren't visitors. And Israel, in some critical sense, wasn't a foreign nation. That we were together, that we believe the same things, that our faiths are in some both mystical as well as political way inextricably tied. That our faith is one. And as, remarkably enough, the head of a Jewish state stood receiving the accolades of all the governing body of the most powerful country in the history of the world, you felt, for just a moment, that for all the times it has been betrayed, and all the times it has failed us, and all the times we have despaired of it, at this moment in our lives, God's central promise is being fulfilled. Shabbat Shalom.